The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Well, first of all, let me wish all of you a happy new year, and let's please hope that 2021 is a little easier on us than 2020 was. And thanks so much for listening to us. We really do appreciate it. All right, let's start off with the Reader's Digest 13 Things. That sounds lucky, doesn't it, number 13? Let's talk about the ultimate TV guide to streaming. Streaming first became popular in 2005 thanks to YouTube. And by the way, most of us have spent a lot of time streaming here this last year. By 2017, more people were watching old episodes of the long-running hit NCIS on Netflix than the newest season in its home network, CBS. The past year, while Sunday Night Football, the most viewed show up on network television, averaged 20 million viewers a night, the debut of Netflix Tiger King drew more than 34 million viewers in its first 10 days on the air. Number two, nearly three-quarters of American households subscribe to at least one video streaming service, with almost 200 million subscribers worldwide and a billion hours of content viewed each week. Netflix is by far the biggest paid service. Number two is Amazon Prime Video. But for every Goliath, there are 100 Davids. Many smaller streaming services focus on niche programming, showing nothing but sports, classic movies, or Japanese anime. Number three, in the early days of streaming, the appeal was the lower cost, and still is. The average streamer spends $37 a month and subscribes to three streaming platforms, while the average cable users pay more than $200 per month. Still, streaming has become more expensive in recent years. In 2019, Netflix raised the price of its basic service 12.5% to $8.99 a month. A quarter of its subscribers who have a history of protesting price increases said they would cancel the subscriptions. Few did. Number five. A major reason streaming networks have become home to many of the most acclaimed TV series, including recent Emmy winners The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Fleabag, and The Handmaid's Tale, they offer full-length feature films as well. And last year, Netflix received more Oscar nominations than any other media company. In fact, streaming has changed the Oscar competition, at least for this year. Usually only films shown in theaters are considered, but because of the coronavirus, all movies released online in 2020 are eligible for the 2021 Academy Awards. Number six. That shift is especially good news for Disney, which had to ditch its planned theatrical releases for two of its anticipated blockbusters, Hamilton and Mulan. Both are now on the company's new streaming service, Disney Plus. But watching Mulan from the comfort of your home will cost a hefty $29.99, on top of the service's monthly fee of $6.99. Number seven. Considering the money and prestige at stake, it's no wonder that competition for programming is fiercer than the fighting in the Game of Thrones. NBC paid $100 million to bring The Office to its new streaming service. Peacock, which is the new home for all shows and movies owned by NBC Universal Warner Media, paid $425 million to get exclusive streaming rights to Friends for its HBO Max platform, which is also the only place to find all eight Harry Potter movies. Some streaming services include an option to add live TV, but it drives up the price. A basic monthly Hulu subscription costs $5.99, with live TV, it jumps to $54.99. Services such as Sling TV offer cheaper packages with only a core group of popular channels. If you want to cut cable but are devoted to a particular network, sign up for a streaming service. Almost every network has one. Most are less than $10 a month. Not sure whether a given service is worth the money? Most offer 7 or 30-day free trial periods. But be careful. They will automatically charge you the day your trial ends. If you buy a new phone, iPhone, iPad, or Mac computer, you get a free year of Apple TV Plus. Verizon Unlimited plan holders get complimentary access to Disney Plus. And T-Mobile offers customers a year of Netflix or Quibi, a new streaming app with shows designed for viewing on the phone. Number 10. There are free streaming services such as Crackle, Tubi TV, and Xumo. That's X-U-M-O. They tend to have fewer titles to choose from or make you sit through commercials. One exception, Canopy, which doesn't show ads and offers 30,000 films. You need a membership card from your local public library to sign up. It's hard to find your favorite shows when streaming platforms are rotating content like museum exhibits, but many smart TVs and media players such as Roku will find them for you. There are also free online databases such as realgood.com and justwatch.com that can locate particular titles. Too much streaming can get you into trouble, however. Nearly half the people who stream shows for their significant other admit to cheating, watching episodes ahead of the other person. And as many as 60% of the cheaters say they could cheat more often if they could get away with it. Number 13. And then there are those who binge watch, a term Merriam-Webster added in 2017 with the definition to watch many or all episodes of a TV series in rapid succession. Alejandro Fargoso of New York City holds the Guinness World Records for the longest bender, 94 straight hours. Money to burn. During the filming of Rush Hour 2, $1 billion in prop money was blown up, but some bills survived and ended up in circulation. This sparked a change in federal rules for the appearance of prop money. Some bills now state for movie use only, and the really convincing fakes can be printed only on one side. Laughter, the best medicine. And there's a cartoon of a cat lying in bed with a radio next to it, and the radio is announcing, "And now, we bring you hours of uninterrupted can opener sounds." How true that is. A couple's doorbell rings while they're sleeping. The husband opens the second floor window but can't see much because of a raging blizzard. "Who's there?" he yells. "Could you give me a push?" a voice cries. "Come on, man, it's 2 a.m., the husband replies. But his wife says, "Remember last winter and you got stuck in a snowdrift and a stranger pushed your car out? You should help this man." The husband agrees and goes back to the window. "Are you still there?" he calls down. "Yes," comes the response. "I really would appreciate a push." "All right," says the husband. "I can't see much out there. Where are you?" "On the sled." Young Billy and Willie were walking home from Sunday school, where they just learned about Noah's Ark. Billy asked, "Do you think Noah did much fishing?" "How could he?" said Billy. "He only had 2 worms. My New Year's resolution is to get in shape. I chose round. Oh, that's so true. A lawyer had an operation. He woke up in his hospital's room afterward and saw that all the blinds were shut. When he asked the nurse why, she said, "There was a fire across the street, and we didn't want you to think that the operation had failed." Oh, that's cold. I love that. If the person who named walkie-talkies named everything, would stamps be licky-stickies? Hippos be floaty-bloaties? Pregnancy tests be baby-babies? A state trooper pulled alongside a speeding car on the freeway. Glancing at the car, he was astonished to see that the elder woman behind the wheel was knitting. The trooper cracked down his window and yelled to the driver, "Pull over!" "No," the woman yelled back, "it's a cardigan." Now, this next article is probably a little more Christmassy than we would normally think, but you've got to remember that Reader's Digest, unfortunately, only does 10 issues a year, and one of them is the December-January, so we kind of overlap into both seasons. A cover story, the season for family miracles, a mother's eerie premonition, an uncle's unusual joyride, the sweet wait for Dad's holiday treat. If you need a little extra warmth this year, these three wonderful stories will do the job nicely. And there's a picture of a beautiful wreath on a red front door, all green with a big red bow. Dad's mystery package. My father resembled a fruitcake. One year he even sent one. It never arrived. A few years ago, my father arranged to send me a mail-order fruitcake at Christmas time. Although I had a good job and owned an apartment in Manhattan, he feared my cupboards and refrigerator might be bare. I had recently moved from California, where my parents still lived in their suburban bungalow of 50 years, the house I grew up in. He wanted me to have a particular brand of fruitcake made in Texas. It was famous among fruitcake lovers, or at least among people who gave fruitcakes to those who were assumed to love them. "It reminds me of my mother's," he told me in a phone call. "Hers was really moist with lots of raisins." I later figured out that my grandmother's version, which I never had the chance to taste, was probably a depression cake, made without milk, sugar, butter, or eggs, scarce commodities when he was a child. Born in 1932, Dad grew up during the Great Depression in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. On most Christmases, he received 2 gifts, a pair of homemade socks and a small sack of oranges. "My mother knitted the socks," he said, "and those oranges tasted so good." Ordering the fruitcake was his way of trying to take care of me from afar, in an era that, in his mind, might at any moment turn economically perilous. Regardless of my middle-aged status, I was still his son. "It should arrive the first week of December," he said. "As soon as you get it, let me know what you think." I've been going to California Christmas, as I do every year, and I was looking forward to his gift, to sampling the flavors that transported him to his childhood. The first week of December passed with no sign of his fruitcake. Delayed by holiday mail, I assumed, or a backlog of orders. I knew there would be plenty to eat in California. In addition to my mother's cookies, fudge, and other treats, my father's always gave my sister and me each a large bag of assorted foods he calls, rather plainly, the food bag. He produced these from some secret spot only after all the other presents had been opened. One year, I listed the contents of my food bag in a notebook. I suppose I wanted a record for myself the day we might not get a food bag for Christmas. That year, my bag contained a can of deluxe mixed nuts, a box of whole wheat crackers, a Belgian chocolate bar, a stick of hickory curd turkey sausage, a half-pound sack of California pistachios, some English breakfast tea, and many other items, including, oh dear, super-duper reindeer pooper jelly bean dispenser, filled with jelly beans. I was 44 when my father gave me that food bag. He was 72. The bags had an uncanny but undeniable kinship with fruitcakes, fritching a little of this and that, frozen together, thrown together with intriguing results. They were so overstuffed that I often had to put most of the food in a box and mail it home. One year, I assembled a few of the healthier items, sardines, rye crisp, dried apricots, on the way to the airport, made a special delivery to my own donation center of a local church. Fruitcakes is a polarizing concept, a triggering word. People love it or hate it, and I like to debate whether it's a cake at all. In some ways, my father's character resembled a fruitcake, whimsy and a little nuttiness mixed with a sweet foundation. When we were children and went to the local shopping mall, he liked to spitz on women's perfume, all of them. This was before men's cologne counters were common. Once they were, he would transform himself into a pansexual bouquet of exotic fragrances. On our drives home, my mother would say, "You stink! What did you put on this time?" While working as a meat cutter in grocery stores, he was called Crazy Charlie for his co-workers, and was known for workplace pranks, such as pretending to lock someone in the walk-in meat freezer. But he also gave out instructions to customers who didn't know how to roast lamb or make stuffing. When he came home from late shifts, he left candy bars under our pillows, thinking we might wake up wanting a snack. My father believed everyone was always hungry and needed to eat. When we visited him in the hospital during our 3-month stay, he was battling a vicious infection after heart surgery. He would ask whether we had eaten and never failed to remind us that the cafeteria would be closing soon. "At least get a cup of coffee," he'd say. "Don't worry about me." A fruitcake in his mind was a perfect Christmas gift. The culinary jumble of jeweled fruit suggested an extravagance that belied in practice. Fruitcake can fill your belly and has a long shelf life. In 2017, a fruitcake thought to have been bought in Robert Scott's Antarctic expedition more than 100 years earlier was discovered to be in excellent condition. There's a picture of a beautiful fruitcake with candy fruit and nuts all across the top of it. Yummy. The day before my flight to California, the fruitcake still had not arrived. When my father called to wish me a safe trip, he said, "Did you receive it?" "Not yet," I said. "It's probably delayed in the holiday mail." "Maybe it'll be there today," he fretted deeply about that lost fruitcake. When I arrived at my parents' home, he said, "Did you get the fruitcake?" "No, but I'm sure it'll be there when I go home." As soon as the words left my lips, I realized that home, for them, was a loud, kind of triggering word. Because wasn't this home? Wasn't I home now? With my parents greeting me, asking whether I was hungry after the long flight. In the living room, a Christmas tree stood above piles of presents and glittery paper. In the spare bedroom, my father, I knew, had hidden our food bags, concealed under large towels. He remained hopeful the fruitcake would come by New Year's Eve, when I'd be back in Midtown Manhattan, humanity roaring from Times Square. January, February, and March came and went with no fruitcake, though my father continued to ask about it. I never once considered lying and telling him, yes, the fruitcake had finally arrived and was delicious. Instead, I said, "That cake is orbiting the earth, and sooner or later it will land." "That's a good one," he said. His sense of humor never wavered, and as time went on, he would bring up the perpetual journey of his fruitcake. "I wonder where it is now," he'd say. "It's taken a detour to Pluto." He liked that one, too. "Do you want me to order another one in case it never comes?" "That's okay, Dad," I said. "I'll wait for this one. It'll taste even better after the touring the cosmos." Early last December, nearly a year after my father died from a falling heart, I got a call from a staffer at the front desk of my apartment building. "You have a package," he said. I went downstairs to pick up. The brown box was a FedEx label with a return address in Texas. It was the fruitcake. That's a cute story. And the next article is Celebrating Like a Man. There's a picture of a man with a big white beard sitting in an old bottle car with a young kid sitting next to him. And this is a drawing, not a photograph. With a bunch of Santa Clauses and people shopping behind him and big lights and everything. Uncle Ed was a tough guy, a few words. But when he took me on a Christmas Eve drive, he gave me the kind of sweet memories that last a lifetime. By Rick Bagg. This is from Southern Living, which is interesting. I waited too late to thank Uncle Ed for that Christmas Eve, but I guess he and I were never the kind of men who wrote many notes or read them. Even around Christmas, when a little silliness and frivolity is easy to tolerate, men of a certain time, place, and class are unlikely to have anything to do with thank you card. We would just as soon go caroling in a light-up sweater. Southern men like us tend to keep the holiday our way and let others keep theirs. Still, some Christmases are kept better than others. Some flash in and out of our memories like a short and an old string of lights. For me, it will always be 1969 that blinks back into my mind this time of year. That was when I first read Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol and saw it come to life, in a way, in the mist-shrouded mountains of northeastern Alabama. I have loved Christmas all my life. As a boy, I loved the grocery store where frozen turkeys and smoked hams piled up like cannonballs. There was, is, a beautiful kind of sturdiness to it here. Mirroring the people. Trees were real and came from these mountains, usually cedars and barely hardy pines. Our mistletoe was procured the old-fashioned way, by blasting it out of trees with a Remington. The ornaments were mostly handmade and almost always crafted from twice-used aluminum foil. The star that crowned a tree in December was probably left over from wrapping a tomato sandwich the summer before. This was my Christmas. It was simple, never fancy. But there was in it a wonderful warmth. Uncle Ed's wife, my Aunt Juanita, filled the whole house with the smell of her peanut butter cookies. Even the desserts were substantial. No sissy divinity candy would be tolerated here. My mama baked pecan pies that were so dense you asked for not for a slice, but a slab. Paper plates buckled under the weight. My aunt just made Joe made cornbread dressing you could eat with a fork like cake. But even this sturdy Christmas was too delicate for Uncle Ed, the hardest working man I had ever known. He thought there was just something wrong about taking time off in the middle of the week, time you could have spent running a chainsaw or on the end of a shovel handle. And Christmas Eve was a workaday like any other. I was 10 years old that year, just idling around the house and yard, prowling through the wrapped presents under the tree, trying with my X-ray eyes to peer beneath the paper of a gift that looked suspiciously like a G.I. Joe. When he asked me whether I wanted to ride to Gadsden with him to look for a used dump truck. Any other time I would have knocked the furniture over getting out the frick-up. Country kids never make a chance to go to town, to go anywhere. But this was the day before Christmas, just hours before all our kin gathered here for a big feast. This year was a deer roast, as big as a buffalo, and a present exchange. Someone might bring a guitar or a French harp and even be brave enough to sing. In the meantime, there were cookies and maybe fudge to steal, ants to irritate, and black and white reruns to watch on channels 640 and 13. Then at 5 o'clock, the weatherman would show us precisely where on his radar Santa Claus was in relation to Calhoun County, Alabama. We believed every bit of it. I would miss it all if I went with him, maybe the whole Christmas. Once he got started on a job, even if it was just a search for a truck, he would hang with it until it was done. Surely it could wait. "You want to go or not?" he asked. I had no spine. "I reckon," I said. It was one of those winter days in the deep south that almost always black by afternoon, so thick was the mist. The low-lying clouds were cold gray. It seemed as if the heater in the old GMC would never warm up, and we were half-day to Gadsden before my toes began to thaw. Parts of the city, an industrial town on the Coosa River, would be brightly lit, and shoppers would throng the downtown. Even Goodyear, even the steel plants, would dock off early on Christmas Eve and join that celebration. But we strayed away from the lights and headed into the graveyards of old machines that had been part of such cities since the start of the Industrial Revolution. We found, I was dismayed to see, a few million used dump trucks. Then in A Christmas Miracle, Uncle gazed down at his Timex and said we had bigger fish to fry. Looking at that truck was just an excuse, a ruse. We were here to celebrate Christmas like men. First, we headed to the day-old bread outlet and filled up the truck with fruitcake, cinnamon buns, and donuts. Next, with powdered sugar on our lips, we turned down Broad Street and idled through the decked-out heart of the city on its most festive day. The storefronts were lit up glowing, crowded with last-minute shoppers. Daddy's rolling new bicycles and Mama staggering under the big boxes. Santa Claus stood ringing a bell on the corner, like it was going out of style. I saw him again in the music store strumming a guitar, and again in what I think was the Western Auto or maybe the Otasco with children on his knee. I asked Uncle Ed which one of them was the real Santa, and he just took a draw on his Winston and told me it was probably that Fustin. Then we turned south toward the Big Chief Drive-In, which had one of the finest hamburgers in northeast Alabama. We got two cheeseburgers each and a pile of fries that burned my fingers. It was too early for supper and way past dinner time, but when you're celebrating, you can ignore such as that. We ate in the truck and savored it all, listening to the radio. I don't remember much being said, but just hearing the song about the drummer boy and the one about the 12 days. Then he looked at his watch again and said, "The women will be pretty riled if we don't get home." But we took our time going back, too, admiring holiday lights, taking the longest way. And before Christmas Eve celebration had even begun, there on Roy Webb Road, we celebrated all up and down Gadsden, Alabama, and the north half of Calhoun County. It was as good a Christmas as I would have for a very long time. I should have told him this when he was alive, but things get awkward the longer you live. So even though it's too late now, I want to thank him for letting me come along. And it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well. Some may hear those words of Dickens and think of the fine literature, but I see Uncle Ed at the glory of an AM radio, smell French fries and Winston's, and hear the ticking of an old Timex that in the most beautiful way didn't mean a thing that day. The Woman in the Red Coat. When my mother died, I thought I'd never enjoy Christmas again. Then my father began dating a woman who shared a most surprising link to my holiday tradition. This is by Jessica Pierce, Round Tootie. Christmas at my house meant fresh pine boughs wrapped around the banister with 12-foot ribbon, candles in every window, and homemade dinners for 20 cooked by Mom. Mom was the only girl in a house full of 4 brothers, so when she had a home of her own to decorate and 2 daughters to dress up, she didn't hold back. Christmas was a month-long ritual we waited for all year, running errands in our matching red coats. On Christmas Day, we'd open up the wreath-covered front door to welcome cousins, aunts, and uncles. Over the years, the dining room table, from my father's own childhood as one of 13 siblings, was adjusted to expand as partners, then spouses, then kids crowded around the table, Mom holding court over us all. I always took for granted that someday my own kids would gather at that same table and enjoy the traditions that had been passed down each December. Life had other plans. Mom found her tumor on my 21st birthday. She was just 53. She died 3 years later on October 20th, 2009. I was only 23. 3 years after her death, I made my annual pilgrimage north from Brooklyn to my childhood outside of Boston for Christmas with my dad and sister. We were all putting on brave faces, but I couldn't stand the bare banister or candleless windows. I channeled my inner Mom and marched up to the attic to hunt for Christmas ornaments. From the attic window, the moonlight on the snow outside made the trees look like construction paper cutouts of themselves. Mom and Dad had built the house on an old Christmas tree farm. "Isn't it wonderful we'd be brown by Christmas all year long," Mom would joke. Now her words seemed more like a reminder of what we once had. Dad was putting the house on the market come summer. Up in the attic, I headed toward a box promising labeled Christmas in Sharpie, moving aside wooden cranberry strands from Mom's peak New England craft phase. An unusual yellowed envelope caught my eye. The return address on it was a famous publishing house in Boston. My mother had been an editor before I was born, but had given up her dream of being a writer when she had kids, or so I thought. Inside was a never-published manuscript for a children's book, dated February 10, 1993. I would have did the math quickly. I would have been 7, my sister 4. The manuscript was titled The Evil Stepmother, Who Wasn't. It's the story of a little girl who loses her mother to cancer. Her father would soon remarry, and Christmas, the girl comes to find her stepmother crying with an ornament in her hand, a star with a woman's photograph. The stepmother reveals that she lost her mother, too, and always misses her most at Christmas. And there's a picture of the author and her sister, and her stepmother and father, and her husband, the author's husband. I read Mom's book under the bare bulb of the attic, surrounded by her things, and wondered why she had been moved to write it. She was years away from her own diagnosis at the time. Did part of her always know? Did losing her brother, whose dog tags were returned from Vietnam at Christmas time the year before I was born, inspire it? Well, she wasn't around to ask. There was no stepmother, evil or otherwise, in our lives. I packed the manuscript away, located the ornaments I came for, and forgot about Mom's book and the craziness of the move that summer. Without the home that had been the anchor for so many memories, I cut Christmas loose. I began to avoid the ringing bells of the Salvation Army, even for a while the color red. Most of all, I avoided holiday music. I shopped online to ensure a carol couldn't reach me unawares. By the way, the picture shows both the author and her stepmother in bright red coats. That changed in December 2017. Dad told me he was seeing someone. Could he bring her to Christmas? Of course, I said, stunned but happy. We hugged each other shyly when we first met. Soon she had Dad and me laughing. It was going so well, the three of us went to a nearby Marshall's to pick out gifts. That's when White Christmas began to play over the store's speakers. I froze. It was a song Mom sang to me as a child to get me to sleep, the closest sound on earth to her voice. The earrings I was holding in my hands blurred as tears streamed down my face. I was mortified. Dad was mortified. I left the earrings and ran for the safety of the car, hoping Dad's girlfriend didn't notice. We got home, and I went to my room to pull myself together. There was a knock on the door. Dad's girlfriend. Can I come in? Sure. She told me that Christmas was hard for her, too, that she had been a caregiver for her mother as she slowly slipped away from Alzheimer's. Do you see this coat? She asked, referring to the red swing coat I had complimented earlier. It was my mom's. Your dad tells me your mother had a red coat, too. Maybe you can wear them together sometime. She handed me a small package. I unwrapped the tissue paper to reveal the earrings I had been holding at the store. I remember the long-ago scene from Mom's book and hugged this woman who made my dad happy, who was offering us a second chance at Christmas. A year later, my sister and I were maids of honor at Dad's wedding. This past December, I hosted my first Christmas in New York, redecorated with ornaments old and new before taking in the city's holiday lights. My stepmother and I walked arm in arm down Broadway in our mother's robin red coats, cherished reminders of the stylish women who raised us. And now, the abdominal snowman. According to Guinness World Records, the tallest snow person in American history was actually a woman, Olympia. Competed in February 2008 in Bethel, Maine, was 122 feet 1 inch tall. Her eyeballs were made of skis. The buttons were truck tires, and her arms were fashioned from 30-foot spruce trees. She was about 11 feet taller than the Statue of Liberty, though she had a much shorter lifespan. The abdominal snow woman. And with that happy article over with, we will switch into Consumer Reports. How to buy an appliance right now. With inventory low, getting what you want fast at the right price isn't so easy. Here's some help. In this new pandemic world, product shortages seem to come in waves. First it was toilet paper and cleaning supplies, then decking lumber, laptops, and yes, appliances. Supply chain holdups from the spring are still affecting what's available now. Almost one-third of standard-sized 24-inch dishwashers have been out of stock at major appliance retailers this fall, compared with just about one-fifth in early January. According to Gap Intelligence, a market research company, 37% of refrigerators have been unavailable on retailers' websites, about double what's usually out of stock. Before COVID-19, when you typed in the model number at some retailer sites, they'd say, available now, or three left, order soon, says CR's head shopper, who buys appliances for our test. Now they sometimes won't give a date at all. Janet Cather experienced the first wait firsthand when it took nearly 4 months for the refrigerator and dishwasher she ordered to be delivered to her in Hartford, Michigan. Cindy Wilmore of Columbia, Tennessee, found a dishwasher she wanted on sale but out of stock and had to wait months until it was back in stock before she could order. In the interim, she had to go to the store 3 times to extend the rain check for the sale price, which expired every 30 days. The dishwasher is now on order, but its projected delivery date is more than 5 months from where Willoughby and her husband had laid eyes on it. Never in a million years did we think it would take this long to replace appliances, she said. We will wait and wait and wait. And if an appliance is available now, you may have to pay more for it. That's because less inventory on hand, retailers are offering fewer discounts than usual. Chris Scurry of Tallahoola, Louisiana, had to deal with runarounds from a big box store and delivery delays for a month before replacing her washer and dryer at an independent retailer and spending $400 more than she wanted to. What's causing all the inventory problems? The shortage began in March when consumers sheltering in place started using their appliance more and ordering replacements and upgrades, but manufacturers, hamstrung by COVID-19-related closings and shutdowns, couldn't meet the sudden increase in demand. There was a period of 6 to 8 weeks when nobody in Asia was making steel, says Tom Derry, CEO of the Institute for Supply Management and Industry Group in Tempe, Arizona. All of that adds up to months of backlog. And what about the higher prices? It's not that retailers are raising them. Their pricing agreements with manufacturers may stimulate that they can't go much above suggested retail prices, says Jason Berry, an industry analyst for the Gap Intelligence, who focuses on large appliances. But he notes that during periods of low inventory, there's less aggressive discounting. Manufacturers we contacted say they're working to fix supply chain problems. Whirlpool, for instance, acknowledged that it had a few brief interruptions in production at its plant, but that we were focused on overcoming these challenges. Bosch said that while it's improving availability, we anticipate we will continue to face higher demand for our dishwashers. Home Depot and Lowe's didn't address the problem when we asked for comment. Just how long will this topsy-turvy market last? Probably through the beginning of next year, at the very best. That's this year. Manufacturers are suggesting we'll see closer to normal inventory wheels during the first quarter of 2021, Barry says. That doesn't mean you're completely out of luck if your dishwasher breaks down right now. Read on for strategies on getting the appliances you need at the best possible price, pronto. How to get around shortages and delays and save. Shopping an independent. Local independent retailers can offer selections comparable to those of big box stores thanks to their membership in cooperative buying groups. As established ND may also have personal relationship with manufacturer representatives they can lean on in times like this to help you get what you want, our head shopper says. Independents may offer other perks as well. Marla Collins of Midlothian, Virginia, for example, says her local appliance dealer gave her a loaner fridge while she waited for her new Whirlpool last summer. The loaner helped tremendously, she says. If you find a big box store has a lower price for an item that's available in independent, see if the indie will price match. This last spring, Francis Book Sanchez found an indie store near Chicago home that matched Costco sale price for a refrigerator and range. It also beats Costco's sale price for a dishwasher and microwave oven by $90 and $20 respectively, and delivery charges were waived, Sanchez says. Use digital resources. Sorry about that. We had a page switch here. Of a retailer's online shopping filters to narrow your search to what's in stock. Warn stores now. If you want to see a model in person, some retailers, like Lowe's, will tell you the nearest store that has it. AJ Madison, which is based in New York but ships nationwide, has a quick ships icon next to products that can usually be delivered within 2 business days from its warehouse. Use the online chat if it's available. We'd hired Home Depot's that a representative spent a half an hour helping us find an in-stock LG French door fridge. Prioritize your must-haves. When inventory is limited, it helps to be flexible with features. For instance, Nishu Varanakar, a market analyst for major appliances at CR, recommends choosing a basic stainless and steel instead of a more specialty finish. Because it's a popular finish, it's often manufactured in larger batches. Consult our appliance buying guides on CR.org to learn about the features of different types. Use the compare option in our ratings to see the features on specific models and our tester results side by side. Consider your floor model with cosmetic flaws. You may be able to get a floor model or an appliance with a few dents or scratches right away and at a discount. Best Buy, for one, has a search filter on its website for discounted open box appliances. We found a GE Spacemaker washer-dryer combination at 28% off. It was in satisfactory condition and may have had minor moderate signs of use that wouldn't have an impact on performance, and it may have lacked non-essential parts. Order up, order and keep browsing. If you see something you want online, buy it, then keep looking. If you found a better or quicker deal, cancel the first order. Big box stores generally allow cancellation and a refund before the appliance is delivered. Just make sure you check policy first, and if you can ensure you can handle multiple purchases on your credit card, or refund may not be instant. Don't forget to haggle. Just because appliances may be harder to come by shouldn't stop you from bargaining. In our recent survey, only 28% of CR members who bought large appliances from January 2019 to April 2020 haggled for a lower price. But 72% of those who did succeeded. The median savings was $113. When we recently called Best Buy about an LG bottom freezer fridge, we were able to get a $25 haul-away fee dropped. John Hinnenkamp, who lives outside of Omaha, got an even better results. After waiting for weeks for a gray GE washer and dryer set from Nebraska Furniture Mart, he settled for a white one instead. When he asked the retailer to make up for his time and trouble, the store discounted $120 from a purchase and waived the haul-away fee. He also got $100 store credit. Why was I compensated? That's simple, Hez. Himmelkamp says, I called them and complained. The squeaky wheel can get the grease. Use your own vehicle. With access to a truck, you can cut the wait for delivery by picking up your appliance yourself, or try what Scott Cook of Cumberland Run Island did. Have it delivered to a nearby location that is offered a better delivery date. When Home Depot gave him a 3-month lead time to deliver a freezer, he entered his sister's address in Massachusetts, 15 minutes away, into the online order. That ended up having a month off the delivery time. At his sister's house, Cook had the delivery crew put the freezer box directly into his truck, and his wife and father helped him unload it at home. Watch out for added fees. Nothing's more frustrating than finally finding an appliance you want only to be priced out of all the unexpected added fees. Research the cost you're likely to see at the 5 major retail appliance dealers where CR members shop most often. That's Best Buy, Costco, Home Depot, Lowe's, and Sears. So you won't be surprised if you'll be ready to haggle. You may be surprised in-home delivery. You may be surprised by how much delivery charges vary. Costco charges nothing to deliver most large appliances. At other retailers, the general rule is that the more you spend, the less you pay. Home Depot charges $59 for purchase less than $398, but nothing if your purchases cost more. The same goes for Lowe's. Best Buy charges $70 or more for purchases under $399, and nothing for those $399 or more. Fees vary if you live in outlying areas. At Sears, you pay $90 no matter how much you spend, though delivery fees for third-party retailers on Sears.com vary. Extra delivery fees. Do you live in a rural area or up 4 flights of stairs? Be prepared to pay more for delivery. Best Buy charges a custom fee for in-home delivery, putting metro areas outside metro areas. For items $399 and over, that fee is reduced by $70. Costco charges more if delivery staff have to climb 3 or more flights of stairs, or use extra equipment, or if you went to your appliance outside the usual weekday 4-hour window. Home Depot, on the other hand, charges as little as $20 if you want to reserve a 4-hour window rather than accepting delivery date without a delivery window. Lowe's charges more for items delivered by ferry. That's interesting, by ferry. And Sears delivery fee in rural areas depends on the zip code. Most retailers don't charge for basic installation of most appliances, including unboxing, placing, and breaking up, hooking up an item, as well as setting up and demonstrating its basic functions. Sears, though, charges $160 to install dishwashers. Other retailers may charge for what they consider to be added installation tasks, such as hooking up refrigerators, dishwashers, gas ranges, and dryers, and over-the-counter microwave ovens. Best Buy charges $136 or more for installing refrigerators with water and ice dispensers if you have no existing water line. The fee goes down to $50 if you pay $200 per year for its total tech support service. Boy, that stuff's expensive. Moving an old appliance to a different room. Costco, Lowe's, and Sears won't charge anything to move that old fridge to the basement, but Lowe's won't help you reconnect it. Best Buy and Home Depot will charge you $25. Hauling away and recycling an old appliance. Best Buy and Home Depot charge $25, and Lowe's and Sears charge $30. Costco doesn't charge for this option. Returns. This one's not a fee, but if you want a refund because your appliance is a dud, you'll need to request it within a time frame as stated by the retailer. Costco gives you 90 days from the date of delivery. Best Buy, 15 days. Lowe's window is 30 days. And with Sears, you have 3 days, plus 30 days to make the return. Home Depot requires customers to report damage or defects within 48 hours of delivery. Returns must be scheduled at the first available date for the delivery service. Restocking fees. Most retailers don't charge, but Sears have a 15% restocking fee for built-in appliances, unless the item is defective. The writing one is delivered or delivered in a state that prohibits its restocking fee. Boy, it sounds like Sears is really trying to get themselves out of business, doesn't it? Don't forget these installation extras. Appliance shopping requires more homework beyond finding the model you want. You'll need measurements to make sure it can fit where you want it to go and can pass through doorways, stairways, and hallways on its way there. You can check measurements and CR's ratings online or on retail websites. You also may find extra parts for installation that aren't always included in the purchase price. Here's a look at what some of those extras might cost. A washing machine. Water hoses, $5 to $30. Clothes dryer. Galvanized rigid duct, $10 to $30. Flexible gas line, $10 to $30. Or 200-volt electric power cord, $10 to $20. Refrigerator. Water supply line for an ice maker, $10 to $25. Electric range. 200-volt power cord, $20 to $30. Professional installation, another cost, may be required. A gas range. A flexible gas line, $10 to $40. How to stay safe if you shop in store. Checking out new appliances can be trickier during the coronavirus pandemic. Some retailers are offering a new way for customers to experience products. Nebraska Furniture Mart in Omaha, for instance, can demonstrate appliance features via video. But if you do have to enter a store, take the following safety precautions. Go when traffic is low. Do a Google search for the retailer to see if you get a chart showing the times when the store is less busy. If you're an older person or in a vulnerable population, shop during any special hours reserved for you. You may have to call to ask. Keep a distance from the store staff and other shoppers. Make an appointment. Set a specific time to meet with a salesperson if possible, so that you don't have to wait around in the store. Prepare questions ahead of time. If you can't make an appointment, don't be shy about telling the salesperson that you want to expedite the shopping process. So no, you don't want to hear the pitch for an extended warranty, or usually doesn't recommend them. CR doesn't recommend them anyway, usually. Plan for contractor payment. Contractless payment. You can download a mobile app, such as Apple Pay or Google Pay, to check out simply by waving your smartphone above a card reader, or pay with a credit card with radio frequency identification technology, which lets you do the same thing without having to swipe the card or sign anything. Wear a mask, bring sanitizer, skip gloves. As with any public outing, remember to wear a mask, bring hand sanitizers that's at least 60% alcohol to use after touching appliances and whether you leave the store. Don't wear gloves because they can give you a false sense of security. You could touch a surface with gloved hands and inadvertently touch your face. Wash your hands with soap when you get home. Prepare for the delivery. Whether you shop in store or online, when the company contacts you before your appliance arrives, ask that the people delivering them follow the safety protocols, including wearing masks, using hand sanitizer, and maintaining a social distance of at least 6 feet when they're in your house. Keep windows open before and after delivery to circulate air, which helps reduce airborne virus particles. If possible, stay out of the room during installation. Clean the appliance, soap and water afterwards, and surround the countertops and wash your hands. Here's kind of a timely article. How race can change your medical care. Certain lab tests provide one result if a patient is black, another if they're not black. Debate over these race adjustments is heating up. how race adjustments work. Medical test results may be reported differently for otherwise identified black and non-black patients. Does that reflect real health differences or a hidden bias? Here's how the question plays out for commonplace kidney tests. A blood test used to evaluate kidney health in a non-black patient. The lab reports the patient's GFR score. In a black patient, the patient's GFR score is increased by as much as 21%. A low GFR score indicates poor kidney function. A higher GFR score indicates better kidney function. What could happen next? To be safe, certain drugs aren't prescribed, or when they are, dosages may be kept low. More medications and higher doses are considered safe for this patient. The patient gets referred to a kidney specialist early for the white. For the black, the patient gets referred to a specialist later. For a white, if a transplant is needed, the patient is eligible earlier. If a transplant is needed for the black patient, the patient becomes eligible later. When Vanessa Grubbs, MD, first met Eli about a decade ago, he was a muscular man in his 50s. Grubbs, a neonatologist at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, was treating him for membranous nephropathy, a serious kidney condition. To take his vitals, she'd get an extra-large blood pressure cuff. Eli is not a patient's real name. Grubbs referred him as the Book of Eli, because when they first met, he looked like Denzel Washington's brawny character in the 2010 action movie by the same name. But over the next 5 years, as his illness progressed, Eli slowly lost some of his bulk. Grubbs switched to a regular-sized blood pressure cuff. Eventually, the condition left Eli's kidney so damaged that it was time to consider an organ transplant. But kidneys are in short supply. About 23,400 transplants took place last year, and approximately 92,000 people are on a national wait list. To get a spot on the list, a patient must have severely compromised kidneys, which doctors watch for using a number called glomerular filtration rate, or GFR. The figure indicates how fast a person's kidneys can filter blood. Only with a GFR of 20 or below can get in line for a kidney from a diseased donor, the main source of kidney transplants. 60 is considered the threshold of normal kidney function. To estimate GFR, a lab will commonly use a blood test to measure a substance called creatinine, then do calculations that factor of a patient's sex and age. They also consider the patient's race. If the patient is black, the laboratory handling the blood test will multiply the initial GFR number by a specific coefficient or ask the donor doctor to do so. For the test Eli underwent, that coefficient was 1.212. So when Grubbs ordered a GFR test for Eli, she got two numbers back. His GFR was estimated at 20, if not African-American, or 24, if African-American. There were no other racial categories. If Eli had been white, his blood test result would have called him for a spot on the transplant wait list. Because he is black, he did not make the cut. Similar race adjustments or corrections crop up in a number of algorithms used in medicine. Some of these algorithms help doctors decipher test results like Eli's. Others assist a doctor in choosing the best diagnostic test, or deciding whether a patient is a good candidate for a particular treatment. Such calculations often adjust for age, sex, and other factors that can help account for a broad physiological differences among patients. But the race adjustments are more controversial. Grubbs, who studied how race affects medical decisions as an associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco, didn't stop with Eli's initial test results. I didn't believe that just because he was black he had a higher kidney function, she says. Weight loss like Eli's can affect some GFR estimates, and he was very close in the transplant cutoff. So Grubbs ordered a more elaborate GFR test, one that she considers to be more precise. The test is onerous, requiring a patient to collect urine samples over a period of 24 hours, in addition to having blood drawn, but it doesn't have a race adjustment factor. The results came back with a single value, 20. Grubbs referred Eli to the transplant center, which later entered his name in the transplant wait list. Now, after a number of other health setbacks, Eli is nearing the front of the transplant line, Grubbs says, and he could get a new kidney within a year. Where race comes in. Race adjustments are based on studies that report differences in measures of organ function or responses to treatments between black people and others. Supporters of such adjustments say they can often steer doctors toward more effective medical care for the black patients. However, a paper published this year in the New England Journal of Medicine raised troubling questions about the race adjustments in 13 clinical algorithms from a variety of specialties. In obstetrics, for instance, if a pregnant woman has had a cesarean section in the past, her doctor can use the vaginal birth after C-section or VBAC risk calculator to help decide which kind of delivery is recommended. But the VBAC calculation makes vaginal delivery look more dangerous for Black and Hispanic women than for others. That may increase the odds they will end up with the C-sections, which generally carry more risk and cost more. Black women are more likely to have a C-section than members of any other racial group in the U.S. Race matters in the emergency room, too. If a patient comes in complaining about abdominal pain, a formula can help medical staff decide whether to run tests for kidney stones. If the patient is Black, the calculation suggests that they are less likely to have kidney stones, reducing the odds that they'll get tested. With kidney disease, race-adjusted scores can affect patients long before they need a transplant, says Nwamaka. This is an African spelling. Nwamaka Nwaka Nia, M.D., a nephrologist and an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, who co-authored an essay in 2019 on how race-adjusted CFR formulas may hurt Black patients. Ideally, medical experts say, clinical algorithms are just one part of how doctors make treatment decisions. However, because a higher GFR estimate can make Black patients' kidneys appear healthier than non-Black patients, they may be prescribed medications at doses that are too high for people with poor kidney function. They could also be get referred to a specialist later, and they may never learn whether the race delayed a potential life-saving kidney transplant. For tips on what to do if you're concerned about your test results, see How to Be Your Advocate at page 50, and we'll look at that. For Inania, such worries hit close to home several years ago. One of her relatives sought care for kidney disease, but was not referred for a kidney transplant evaluation because of his race-adjusted GFR value was close to 20. Like Inya, he is Black. Inya eventually persuaded him to switch to a new doctor who ordered more testing and ultimately got on the wait list. Those few years of Black and forth could have been spent on transplant wait list, he tells CR. Several years were lost because of one number. What studies show or don't, to people outside the medical field, it may seem surprising that a patient race can be used to help make profound healthcare decisions. But there's an unwillingness to even imagine how to practice medicine outside of race, says Dorothy Roberts, J.D., a professor of law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Roberts and other critics say that race adjustments are based on a flawed understanding of race. It's promoting the idea that Black people as a race are distinguishable biologically, just because of their race, from other human beings, Roberts says. Yet races are loosely defined social categories that change over time. No genetic test or biological marker places someone in one race or another. What if one of your parents identifies as white and the other as Black? Should your doctor use a race adjustment with lab test? There's no meaningful way to decide. Race adjustments GFR can be traced to a 1990 study that found Black people had higher concentrations of creatinine than white people whose kidneys were filtering blood at the same rate. The authors proposed multiplying a Black person's serum creatinine test result by a coefficient to adjust the score. Doing that, they concluded, would give a better picture of the patient's real kidney function. A later study found similar but smaller differences. No one knows just what caused the difference between Black people and others in the two studies, and many critics think that race adjustments should be eliminated for GFR and other kinds of medical tests. But not everyone agrees. We need to slow down as a community of physicians to figure out how best to do this, says Nee Powell, M.D., chief of medicine at the Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital. Powell and a number of other doctors and researchers worry that removing race adjustments without more study could hurt Black patients. What if their kidneys start to look worse than they really are? That could lead to under-medication for pain or illnesses such as cancer, fewer chances to be included in clinical trials, and require well-functioning kidneys, and even higher life insurance premiums. One thing people on all sides of the debate agree is American health status varies by race. On average, Black Americans are more likely than white Americans to have health problems such as diabetes, stroke, high blood pressure, and childhood asthma. The question is why and how doctors should use that information. For instance, beyond race, asthma is strongly associated with environmental factors such as poverty, outdoor air pollution, and from sources including diesel exhaust and smoking. So does it make more sense to note whether the child's asthma is Black or what their living conditions are like? The U.S. has a long and often ugly history of race-based medicine, which goes far beyond the infamous Tuskegee syphilis study, in which hundreds of black men were kept in the dark about their diagnosis and went untreated for decades, while observers reviewed the devastating progression of the disease. In one example before the Civil War, a Southern physician named Samuel Cartwright used a device called a spirometer, which measures lung capacity, to conclude that black people had lower lung capacity than similar white people, a deficiency that he said made them less alert and unfit for freedom. Spirometers were still used today, and modern studies found that the measurements tend to differ by race. As a result, tests of lung capacity often include race adjustments. Some readings that seem abnormally low for a white person might fall into what is considered normal range for a black person. That can affect how patients are diagnosed and treated. We rarely really stop doing these black-white comparisons and just assuming that black people are inherently different, Gruber says. How to be your own advocate. If you're concerned that the treatment or a loved one is receiving for a chronic condition such as kidney disease, hypertension, or cancer might be influenced by a race-adjusted medical algorithm, here are actions you can take. Ask your doctor how race will be used. If you have kidney disease and are black, ask what this means for my current care, says University of Pennsylvania assistant professor Niraka Emial said. And if I am unable to receive certain specialty referrals or treatments, are there alternative measurements of kidney function that can be used that do not include race? Discuss your health and family medical history in detail. The more your doctor knows about your specific circumstances, the less likely they may be to rely too heavily on a race-adjusted algorithm. And 3, if you think your race has influenced your treatment, ask to see a specialist. In many cases, they will be better equipped than a primary care doctor to evaluate health issues for your specific condition and are less likely to rely on a single test or two that may employ a race adjustment. And a real quick filler for the last couple of seconds here. Changing the filters yourself, two filters you can change yourself. Changing two filters yourself can save $20 to $50 in labor costs for each owner's manual and online videos guidance for these quick and simple jobs. Engineer filter, this is an easy-to-reach spot under the hood on a plastic box that snaps, opens, or unbolts. Cabin air filter, this is a bit trickier to change. It's usually under the dash or behind the glove box. Make sure you can move it before spending money on a replacement filter. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening to us.